Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody. I am very thrilled and delighted to have with me Jay Harmon and Francesca Bertoni, who together have a business, Pax Scientific, and Jay has written a wonderful book called The Shark's Paintbrush, Biomimicry and How Nature is Inspiring Innovation. So Jay started out, he's an Australian, started out with the Australian Fisheries and Wildlife, and then went on to found and grow several multi-million dollar research and manufacturing companies that develop a whole bunch of innovative products that are based on forms found in nature. And we're going to talk about that today. His latest venture is Pax Scientific, and it has several subsidiaries, which he and Francesca founded in 1997. And he has a bunch of other interesting adventures. He started boarding schools to teach kids about the environment. He's a champion skin diver, a world-class ocean sailor. He has restored the sister ship to Jacques Cousteau's Calypso and made it his mission to bring the subject of biomimicry to the public. Jay's goal, both as author and entrepreneur, is to show industry that improving the efficiency of industrial equipment is beneficial for both the bottom line and the planet. And Francesca has a background in the life sciences and education. She started her career right here in California's public school system as a vice principal and program director. Then she met Jay. Lucky her. Together they founded Pax Scientific, and Francesca has been its chief operating officer, which includes coordinating PAC systems and legal agreements. And along with her work at PAX, and we'll have her talk about this, Francesca is the executive director of a nonprofit called Nature of Hope that supports biomimicry education. So welcome to the show, Jay and Francesca.
Good morning.
Thank you very
much.
Good
to be
here. Hi. So I'm very excited to have you here. I think biomimicry is a fascinating topic that, although the term is kind of new, the idea is not new. Indigenous people indeed have been looking at nature and drawing inspiration and ideas for centuries. But can you tell us about biomimicry? What is it? How did it come into your life?
Well, I had the good fortune of growing up on a beach in Australia, well, within walking distance of a beach, and I spent every spare minute I had there from the time I was a little tacker. And so I got really enthralled with nature's systems and how it works, and I would surf and swim and so on and so forth. And I noticed over years that natural organisms, like fish, for instance, are extremely good at what they do. And natural design is so elegant compared to anything humans do. So I got completely immersed in that. And I ended up, really, I would call myself a naturalist. As a kid, an amateur naturalist. And I read everything there was to see about naturalists that were on adventures around the world. And biomimicry is really just humans looking at how nature does design or how it solves problems, how it achieves its goals. And humans look to nature to see if there's something to learn from that that can teach us how to conduct our lives or how to design our systems in a more efficient way. And as you mentioned, humans have been doing this since time began. I mean, Australian Aboriginals, for instance, created the boomerang. Well, if you look at a properly made boomerang, it's a marvel of flight. It's a reverse engineered bird wing, and it's aerodynamically extremely efficient. So that's a very early example of biomimicry, and pretty much everything that humans have done over the last 10,000 years, we've really taken from nature. But at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we sort of forgot about it. We forgot about looking to nature because we were able to use lots of energy and steam engines and so forth to stamp out flat plates and cut square pieces of wood, etc. So we really didn't look to nature very much for inspiration until pretty much the Second World War or just after it. And I can give you some examples of that.
Okay, and nature builds things differently too. You mentioned stamping things out of flat plates where, you know, nature, in fact, coming from the genetic code, builds things up one molecule at a time, so it doesn't waste.
Exactly. If you think of a tree, nature is building a structure there to for photosynthesis. So you have the trunk of the tree, which is this wonderful structural thing that's incredibly strong and efficient at doing what it's doing. And nature has built that whole thing by adding one molecule onto another. So when we want to create a post, like a lamp post or a post in a building, we get a tree and we cut it into a certain shape. So we end up with lots of offcuts and sawdust, and we have to carry all of this waste around and then dispose of what we call waste. Well, nature has no waste. There's no sawdust or offcuts. It builds exactly what it wants, and that tree is not overbuilt. It's built exactly to the standards that are necessary to achieve the result.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Brilliant design and engineering. Your book has just lots and lots of wonderful examples of nature's effective ways of solving specific problems, although they're not really problems per se. Everything from the mosquito proboscis to butterfly wings, maggot to whale fins, gecko feet, honeycombs, termite mounds, and a little critter called a tardigrade, which I had never heard of. Do you have any particular favorites of the biomimetic applications that you describe in your book?
Well, I do, actually. Well, first of all, I'd say my favorite is nature, because if you think about it, there's at least 3 million species on Earth, and many scientists are saying there's probably 100 million species on Earth. And every one of those species or organisms has evolved hundreds, if not thousands, of solutions to the problems that humans are facing. So nature's already solved everything that we need to learn, basically, and it's done it in a clean, green, and sustainable way. So there's a level of elegance and sophistication that is, for me, awe-inspiring, and it doesn't really matter what it is. The list that you just mentioned, for instance, or if I go through some specifics, you know, well, probably many people have heard of Velcro, for instance, and it came from an Austrian hiker in the mountains who kept getting seed burrs in his socks, and very annoying. We've all been there. He looked at it under a microscope and discovered the hook and loop system that he then went on to invent Velcro with, which is everywhere now. So, you know, that's an early form of it, but some of the things that I found quite surprising and pretty amazing is that if you just think of battery technology, I mean, the modern world would cease to function if we had no batteries. the phone I'm talking on, or my iPhone, or my computer, or our cars, or whatever. The batteries are everywhere, right? So, and a couple of hundred years ago, an Italian was studying electric eels, because scientists around about 1800 were fascinated by electric eels because they could give enough shock to knock down a horse. And they couldn't work out what was going on because they had no idea about electricity. Our inventor, biomimic Alessandro Volta, dissected an eel, and he found all of these bundles of muscles, and he recreated it in the lab using metals, and he created the battery. And so that is a great example of biomimicry, and probably one of the most significant that we have in the modern era. But there's endless examples. I mean, truly endless examples. And one of my favorites is, if you think of sunblock, I've spent most of my life in the sun, either sailing or, as I said, on beaches, etc., out in the bush. And so sunblock is pretty important. And there's 1,800 different products sold in America as sunblock. And unfortunately, most of them are not effective. They either cut out UVA or UVB, but not both. And very often the chemicals that they are delivered in are toxic when absorbed through the skin. So some folks at UC Merced and others went out and said, well, nature has to deal with ultraviolet. What animals out there have strategies that might be inspiration for us? And they discovered that hippopotamus sweat is actually an extremely good sunblock. It's antifungal, antiparasitic, antiseptic. It's waterproof. It's non-toxic. You put a drop on your hand and it spreads by itself because the hippopotamus doesn't have opposable thumbs to spread by itself. And so now they're reverse engineering those molecules, and that is going to be the basis for sunblocks in the future. That and strategies like that from nature. So, and this is a $600 million business. So biomimicry has the potential to change each and every industry that we're involved in. And another one is shark skin. You know, I've swum with sharks. They're impressive animals. I've seen them when I've been sailing across an ocean. A Mako shark can travel at 45 miles an hour when it's on the hunt, which is an extraordinary burst of speed. And yet most of the time a shark is swimming around at very, very low speed. And anything that is in the ocean for any length of time traveling at low speed is going to get seaweeds and barnacles growing on it. So a shark has a strategy to avoid that. And what it does, it's, you know, when humans want to make something go fast, we tend to polish it. We like to take all the obstructions away, like our racing cars are polished and polished and polished, or our racing boats. Nature doesn't do that. It doesn't actually polish anything. It makes a rough surface. Even a dolphin will get goosebumps on its skin when it wants to go fast. So this shark has a very rough skin, in fact. Cabinet makers in the past used to use shark skin for sandpaper. Now, how does this work? Well, that rough shark skin, as the water's going past, each of those little protuberances in the skin roll up the flow into little vortices, little whirlpools, and they act like ball bearings so that the shark can move with much less friction through the water. On top of that, the surface is of such a design that bacteria can't colonize on it. And because bacteria can't colonize and stick to that skin, weeds don't grow. And then because there's no weeds or algae, then barnacles don't grow. So it's a remarkable strategy. And now folks have created paints that you can put on aircraft and the bottom of ships. that make an enormous difference to the amount of friction and therefore the amount of fuel that that aircraft and ships need to use, and therefore reduce pollution in really dramatic ways. So the list goes on and on. You know, there's about 100 different examples in the book, and we know of, at the moment, of about 2,000 initiatives that are happening in the world and growing very rapidly. And, you know, there's not that many places in the world that actually call it biomimicry. America, of course, Australia. But in Europe, for instance, it's more referred to as bio-inspired, or and there's several terms. But if you know what you're looking for, you can find many, many examples that people are doing around the world.
Yeah, so how has nature inspired you? I know you were very inspired by the vortex shape.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I got my first goggles, you know, underwater goggles when I was 9. And I put my head under the water, and in Australia the water's clear and it was warm, and I put my head under and I saw all the fish and this beautiful landscape and seaweeds and everything else. And I was absolutely fascinated and hooked, and I, you know, became my passion for the rest of my life. And so skin diving is, I just absolutely love. But one of the things I got fascinated by as a little kid was I wanted to catch fish. I wasn't very good at it, but I used to swim around with a broomstick with a piece of fencing wire attached to one end, sharpened, and that was my spear. And I used to swim around trying to catch fish. Well, there was no chance. But I noticed that fish were extremely good at swimming. And I was reasonable as far as humans go, but I couldn't get close to them. And so I used to sit in class and daydream about this. And, well, what are these fish doing? And what could I do to improve my swimming ability? And so it was an obsession. And really didn't do much schoolwork. I'd just sit at the back of the class and tune out and run down to the beach as soon as class was finished. And over a period of time, I noticed if I was swimming along rocks at the surf line and a wave would come, I'd grab onto some seaweed to stop myself being washed onto the rocks. And most seaweeds are pretty fragile. You can break them off quite easily with your hands. But I noticed that even in the wildest storms and the biggest waves, those seaweeds hang onto the rocks just fine. They don't break off. And I found that intriguing. So over a period of time, I noticed that these weeds were all changing their shapes into all sorts of swirling positions. Now, when you first look at it, it looks chaotic. You know, it's like when you see the breeze going through the leaves of a tree, all the leaves are moving in a seemingly chaotic way. In actual fact, they're all changing their shape into the shape of the whirlpool that's in your bathtub when you pull the plug. That whirlpool is the archetypal shape that nature uses for friction reduction. And it's a whirlpool, and a whirlpool is essentially frictionless. Remarkable thing. There's almost no friction. So nature uses that shape whenever it needs to move anything, whether it's the blood in our veins or the air that we breathe through our trachea, or the thermals over the land that birds fly on, or the way that fish swim or insects fly. They're all using these little whirlpools of either water or air to leverage and to cut their drag and friction. So the whirlpool in your bath is nature's path of least resistance. So it's the tool that nature uses everywhere. And we see it in spiral galaxies. We see it in the smallest particles, in the particle accelerators. So over a lifetime, I just noticed more and more and more examples of how this whirlpool shape is absolutely fundamental to how nature works. And it's how nature manages to achieve what it does using far less energy than anything humans do. And as I got older and, you know, in high school and studying science, I remember a teacher in the physics class starting a lecture saying, the shortest distance between two points, like the ends of the football field, the shortest distance is a straight line. So therefore, if we want to use the least amount of energy, we have to travel in a straight line to cover the shortest distance. Well, it makes perfect sense, and that's what we learned in school. But I'm sitting in class saying, nature doesn't use straight lines. In fact, there's not a single example in the natural world in the whole history of our universe where nature has ever traveled in a straight line. It always travels in these swirling shapes. So for me, that became a huge question. Well, why is this? Science uses straight lines, and we use huge amounts of energy and create huge amounts of waste. And nature never uses a straight line, and it uses far less energy. So that became a lifetime fascination, and that's what all of the PAX companies are based on, is implementing those swirling shapes into the way that humans design and build systems.
So all kinds of things, from fans to mixers, you have something that with the energy of a couple of light bulbs, if I recall correctly, can keep the water flowing in, these big water tanks that communities have. So they can reduce the amount of chlorine that's used. So you can keep our water fresher, essentially, just by swirling it.
Well, it's... As you say, in our drinking water supply, we're all familiar with these huge tanks that sit up on the top of hills, or in the Midwest, they're up on towers. And we fill them up with water and hold that water there to gravity feed to our houses. And we keep that water for firefighting and all sorts of things. Well, a lot of those tanks are millions of gallons in size. A lot of them are 10 million gallons, which is the size of a football field, 30 feet deep, which is a huge amount of water. Most of those tanks are made of steel. So at ground level, the water is cool or cold. But with the sun beating down on the top water gets hot. And because all of our water supply has to have disinfectant chemicals put in it, a lot of those chemicals become fertilizer, especially in hot water. And so you get algal blooms in the top of these tanks. We can't have that. So municipalities put in more chemicals. And a lot of these chemicals are carcinogenic. They're not very nice if we get the flavor of it in our water supply, which happens from time to time. So we created a company called PAX Water. And we went to municipalities and said, you know, you'd have a lot less trouble, a lot less cost, and a lot less chemistry if you circulated that water. Well, to circulate 10 million gallons of water would take a very expensive piece of equipment and lots of energy. We offered an alternative. What we did was if you imagine you're in the bath, you pull the plug, you get that whirlpool. If you froze that whirlpool, if you could capture that whirlpool, that shape, that's what we did, and we turned it into a little stainless steel whirlpool. It actually looks just like a whirlpool, and it's 6 inches high and 4 inches in diameter, and we rotate that with a little motor that uses the power of a couple of light bulbs, and it sits on a little tripod. So now we take that device, the whole thing is 3 feet high, and we put it in the center of one of these 10 million gallon tanks. So you imagine that. You've got a 6-inch by 4-inch device sitting in the middle of a football field. And when we turn it on, we rotate it at about 1,200 revs a minute. And that little device, it's a frozen whirlpool. As it rotates, it turns the whole water body into a whirlpool. And remember, a whirlpool is frictionless. So whatever energy you put into it gets translated into mixing all of that water. So we create this enormous mixing structure. It's a ring vortex. And what we've been able to do is reduce the amount of chemistry that goes into those tanks by 85%. And, of course, the cost of mixing is next to nothing. It's a couple of light bulbs of power. Well, of course, we went out to municipalities and engineering firms, et cetera, and they all thought we were mad. How could you possibly have so much effect on such a big area of water with such a tiny thing? So we had to spend several years trying to convince people to even look at it. Well, now I'm happy to say it's in more than 1,200 municipal tanks across the United States, Australia, and the Middle East. And it's 100% effective in 100% of applications. And the company is growing exponentially. So this, to me, is a classic case of nature designing a system that is way beyond anything humans can do. This is biomimicry, and this is what we can do pretty much with any industrial system, anything that humans do today, whether it's designing chemicals to wash our dishes with or delivering water in pumps or, you know, trying to protect salmon going up rivers and over dams, fans, turbines, how you design an engine, how you design an aircraft. Anything that we do as humans, nature's already doing better.
Yeah, wow, that's fantastic. The things you've described are very cool applications. You know, they're neat products that do really great things. But in your book, you say that biomimicry isn't just that. It's not just about developing, you know, cool new products. It's about learning to see and to think differently, like to think like a forest or like an ecosystem. And so I'd like to expand our conversation into that realm. And how indeed do ordinary people like you and me come to see, you know, our world around us, or think like a forest? Can you, and Francesca, jump in at any time if you want to
sure.
to add to this.
Place that I can jump in. I think that this is a really important point, and it's something that, as a non-engineer, a non-scientist, I'm always saying to Jay, well, what about just the person that's, you know, you're running your household or you're a business person? How can those people learn from the same lessons that nature is teaching? And so that is something that is really interesting to me. And in Jay's book, there is a section that talks about some work that's being done by industrial ecologists. So industrial ecologists look at industry, they look at ecology, they try to take lessons from both. And there are actually 10 principles that have been identified that make a very complex ecosystem like a forest. That's not just like one little plant. Those are a bunch of plants and animals and weather and soil and so forth all working together, which really starts to mirror some of the things that go on in our homes and our businesses. And there are 10 principles that have been identified that really anybody, no matter whether you're just, you know, living in an apartment or you're running a business, you could take a look at these principles, start to apply them. And so at PAX, we said that. We said, okay, well, let's walk the talk. Let's try it. So some years ago, we just took one principle a month. We would read it out at our first of the month staff meeting and just take a few minutes to talk about what that might mean. Then just let it go. Let people think about it. And then before the end of the month, we'd come back together and say, well, anybody have any ideas? Anything we might be able to apply from that? And boy, we got some great ideas from the staff, and we would just try them. And so in 10 months, we covered all the principles, and those things are impacting us still now. So concrete example. We have supercomputers in our offices. They use thousands of dollars a month in electricity because we have to keep the room that they're in at a really stable temperature. You know, Northern California, it's not the hottest place on the planet, but it gets warm in the summer. And so we're using a lot of electricity to cool that room and keep it stable. In the meantime, we've got a lab that would get really cold in the winter and people were turning on the heat. So one of the principles is to use waste as a resource. As Jay said earlier in the call, there's no such thing as waste in nature. There's no such thing. So, you know, it seems sort of obvious when you think about it, but someone said, well, there must be a way to take the heat from the supercomputer room and just route it back toward the lab, at least in the winter, so that we're not trying to keep the supercomputer cold in the winter when it's already cold in the lab. Let's let the lab do the work. So we actually took that, if you will, waste heat from the supercomputer room, and we were able to just funnel it back into our lab. And, I mean, we're talking about thousands of dollars that we saved every year from that. Again, seems kind of simple, but it was really a big impact. And now every year it's kind of fun. We say, oh, the weather's getting cooler. Okay, let's reroute it and climb around and get the supercomputer heat shunted back into the lab. So very concrete example, but it's the kind of thing that anybody can do if you just give it a little thought. Another one of the principles is to gather and use energy efficiently. I mean, that's, again, it sounds kind of obvious, but if you just take a few minutes and kind of think about your home, the statistics are pretty impressive. If every home in the United States replaced one of their incandescent light bulbs that they still had with one of these newer light bulbs, whether it's a CFL or LED, you know, we're going in a lot of new directions with light bulbs. But if every home in the United States did that, we could save the energy equivalency of taking 800,000 cars off the road. I mean, that's just kind of a staggering number, but that's the kind of impact we can have by making just a few little changes. So I won't go through all of the 10 principles, but they are in Jay's book. They're also in Janine Benyus' book, Biomimicry. The book is called Biomimicry. So if any of the listeners want to dig into either of those, I have found it personally and also professionally in our business, it's been really helpful. And in terms of just nuts and bolts, how to become more biomimetic in your thinking, just to walk out the door and spend some time in nature. That is really one of the most amazing things that we have found as we have worked with our own staff, with colleagues. Just get out the door. Scientists are learning now that it actually changes our brains and our nervous systems in ways that we don't even realize. Humans are really, we're not really used to being indoors. There have been far, far, far more millennia that we haven't been indoors. So just spending more time outside in nature. And in terms of the impact it can have, although, you know, luckily most of us aren't in the correctional system, that some research was done just a couple of years ago. They took photographs of forests and put them in a mural on on the wall of an exercise yard in a prison. It dropped violence by half. So that was
wow.
The most of nature. I know, it's very impressive. So this is the kind of thing that we're, you know, there's an entire field, one of the overlapping study areas to biomimicry called biophilia, B-I-O-P-H-I-L-I-A, biophilia. So if any of the listeners are saying, wow, it's interesting stuff, go do some searches on biophilia. That's the whole study of how nature affects us as people and vice versa. So those are just, you know, a couple of the ways that anybody, I mean, you do not have to be a scientist. You don't have to, you can be a student, a banker, a parent. You can use these principles in your day-to-day life.
And particularly if you go into nature, anything you see, whether it's a blade of grass or a bird or a feather or anything, if you're interested, ask the question, why? Why is it like that? Why is that color like that? Why is that structure like that? Nature doesn't invest in accidents. I mean, yeah, you get little perturbations, etc. But if you see something that's been adopted by nature across a species, it's there for a reason. And it's always there. Nature always uses the least materials and the least energy to get the maximum job done. So every single strategy you find in nature is something that can be inspirational to us. And just one little example of this, because you know, we're not only surrounded by it, we are it, you know, because we're part of nature too. Nature evolved us. If we touch the tip of our tongue to the roof of our mouths, we notice there's ridges. And they sort of feel a little bit like waves on the ocean. Well, those ridges are, you'll see also in the bottom of a stream in the sand, or in when waves are coming ashore, you'll see these little patterns in the sand. What are they there for? You know, if every human has those, they've got to be there for a reason. Well, it turns out it's a little bit like the shark skin, and you're running across the Serengeti with a lion chasing you down. You want to be able to breathe in and out as deeply and as quickly as you possibly can. You want all the oxygen you can get. So those ridges cut drag. That's just one of the things those ridges do. But they actually cut drag, so you're getting better airflow. So just something like that. Imagine if we put those ridges into the design of our cars. We could cut the drag on cars. Instead of having these slick, shiny cars, they could still be slick and shiny, but imagine if we had wave patterns in the surface. We'd use less energy.
Wow. You know, I've never... That's great to ask why, because I've felt those ridges in the top of my mouth as long as I've been aware of the top of my mouth.
Right.
And I've never asked,
exactly,
why are they there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you.
So we're all biomimics if we just ask why. And here's the thing. There's so many things that humans do, and so many widgets we do, and so many methods we do, and processes we do. And I mean, talk about multitasking as a species. But every one of those tasks can be improved if we look to nature for inspiration. So every one of us could become the discoverer or inventor of some really profoundly important thing. It's really that simple. I mean, me as a little kid just noticed seaweed changing its shape because I was curious why fish swam so well. You know, so patterns in nature or designs in nature, I could go on and on, as you can imagine. And the book does give some pretty good insight into what people are doing. And there's a wonderful website, asknature.org, which is put out by the Biomimicry Institute. And it has thousands of those questions. And it says, okay, if I want to solve a problem, where has nature done something like that? And Ask Nature will actually give you some examples. So it's an incredibly interesting, makes incredibly interesting reading for anybody. But it's a wonderful education tool for kids and also for scientists, people that are looking to create new solutions. This is a Kickstarter, if you like. And even though they've got thousands of pieces of data in there, it hasn't even scratched the surface of what's possible. If you imagine millions of species with thousands of solutions, and by the way, 99.99% of all organisms that have ever lived are now extinct. But in their skeletons and in their remnants, there is evidence of the solutions they used. So we can discover all sorts of things just by looking at a fossilized seashell or a dinosaur skeleton, or you know, any living thing today that's ancient. Some of the most ancient life forms that exist today have been extremely successful in all sorts of changing conditions. So what are the keys to those successes? That can teach us incredible things.
Yeah, that's a wonderful resource. There's a couple of others that you mentioned in your book, too. There's one called Biomimicry 3.8, and then talk a little, too, about your own nonprofit, Nature of Hope.
We founded Nature of Hope because we realized that biomimicry really doesn't need... It has fantastic resources out there. What it needs, actually, is almost like a marketing arm, something to just make noise about biomimicry, and that's why Jay has donated all the proceeds from his book to the nonprofit. And it really is a chance for us just to help promote other biomimicry resources. Now, we are working on curriculum in the nonprofit itself that are specifically around the vortex and spirals, because that's obviously the work that we do at PAC. So that's one thing that's in progress. But in the meantime, it's really a chance for us to point people to, as you said, Lisa, Biomimicry 3.8. Now, this is a great organization. They have two branches. One is really focused on educating professionals, people that are scientists, that are designers, people that are in business that want to have someone come in and teach them how to do biomimicry in their business. And that's under the biomimicry, you can find it under biomimicry.net. There's also the Biomimicry Institute. And the Biomimicry Institute is a phenomenal, phenomenal resource for learning about biomimicry. They both do. They cross over. In other words, you know, it's not like a wall between them. You can get between the websites. But the biomimicry.org, if you go to biomimicry.org, you can learn about biomimicry. You can learn about resources for kindergarten through university level. You can join up and become a member of their networks. They've got global, all over the world now. There are organizations where you can go and listen to lectures, get advice from someone, call someone up and ask them for ideas to solve a problem that you have. They've got all kinds of links there. Because as you said, Lisa, it's not just about designing neat widgets. I mean, widgets makes it sound so unimportant. But, you know, there's amazing work being done in chemistry, architecture, on and on and on. But there are also folks that are thinking about, well, how would you use biomimicry to invest your money more wisely? How would you use biomimicry to even design a school better in terms of how children learn? How does nature learn? And so people that are really looking at more of the social aspects and the sociological aspects. So that's, again, biomimicry.org. There's also links there to asknature.org, which is what Jay was talking about. This group, Biomimicry 3.8, does design challenges where they will put out a challenge and anybody from around the world can be at high school level, college level. They've got different challenges. Even they've now started working with younger kids, and they'll put out a challenge and all over the world people can register and log in their ideas, and then they have times when people can come together and share them. It's really a fantastic organization. So I'm, as you can hear, 100% enthusiastic about that. There are other groups that are doing around the world, not just in the United States, that are doing something similar. But again, the fact that Biomimicry Institute has this global network means that even if you are somewhere else in the world, you can hook into their resources.
And also, it was founded by Janine Banyas, who coined the word biomimicry. So it was the first one off the blocks, and it has, as Francesca said, a very big following and a lot of dedicated people that are just passionate about this and really, really excited about sharing all sorts of information with as many people as they can.
And because it is a nonprofit, all of their resources are freely available, so you can download lesson plans. As I said, if you're a teacher and want to say, wow, I've got to start getting into this, you can actually download lesson plans. You can link up with other teachers. But even if you're just an individual that wants to learn more, they've got nice little online videos where it talks about biomimicry, how to think more like a biomimic. There are all sorts of things. So it's just a fun place to go and wander around and see what's there.
And the beauty
great.
Of biomimicry. Sorry, Lisa.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, the beauty of all of this is, you know, we all know our world's got all sorts of extraordinary challenges right now, from global warming to resource depletion to pollution, you name it. We know. Anybody that thinks, anybody that reads knows that we have a very uncertain future if we keep doing things the way we've been doing them. The beauty about biomimicry is nature is a survivor. It's clean, green, and sustainable. It only does things that are conducive to life. So if we adapt and adopt nature's strategies into the things that we do, first of all, there's not a single thing that humans do that can't be improved by biomimicry. And if we do that, then we can become sustainable, completely sustainable. And if we don't become sustainable, what are we? We're terminal. So we have a choice. And the beauty is now that we have the role model, we have the blueprints, we have the library. We have this extraordinary library that's beyond anything that we've ever imagined. called nature, we can solve these problems, and we can do them pretty quickly. And that is what a wonderful gift to give to our kids, that they actually have a future that they can be in charge of, and it's a positive future where we can clean up the mistakes, where we can solve the problems, and we can make a really much more abundant living circumstance for everybody on Earth. The result, the solution is there. It's in hand, and it's happening. And you know, the Point Loma Nazarene University has been studying this for some time, this trend, and where it's going to go to. And they're predicting that within 10 years, there'll be $1 trillion worth of global GDP generated from biomimicry. And that'll double in the next 7 years. So this is a groundswell. It's the biggest technical revolution that human beings have ever seen, and we're just at the beginning of it. And it's inevitable. A couple of reasons. You know, the world is run pretty much by economists and accountants. So it has to, anything we do has to make sense on the bottom line. Otherwise, it's not going to get attention. Well, biomimicry actually increases the profits of corporations and individuals because you're using less material, less energy, and you're getting a better result. And the other thing is it can eliminate liability. When you go to green chemistry, for instance, humans have created 80,000 chemicals. Mm-hmm. Hardly any of them have been tested for toxicity in the environment. And right. We know the consequences of many of those chemicals and pharmaceuticals. They're problematic with lots of side effects. Nature doesn't create those kinds of conditions. Its chemicals are green and sustainable. So
and
corporations switch over to that, they eliminate liability. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just adding that the chemicals that nature produces, our bodies are built to metabolize. The artificial chemicals, our bodies are not built to metabolize, and hence the diseases that are showing up that, you know, weren't so prevalent in even the near past.
Exactly right. And, you know, some people will say, well, nature creates some incredibly potent venoms and toxins, but the answer to that is that, yes, but they're extremely specific, and they're for defense or to gather food. And they're very specific to one of a species. Let's say a snake bites a mouse. Well, it's only one mouse out of the entire species. It doesn't alter the balance of life at all. Whereas human-built chemicals are indiscriminate and permanent. They go into the landscape and they stay there for millennia, many of them. Whereas a snake's venom degrades very quickly. So nothing in nature permanently destroys life.
Yeah. Well, we're coming on down to about 10 more minutes in the show. And I want to encourage the listeners to take a look at The Shark's Paintbrush, which is a fantastic and inspiring book. But I also know that you're writing some new books. So can you tell us a little bit about what's coming up in the future with your new book, Jay?
Well, the first one, in fact, they're both pretty much written, and we're editing right now, so hopefully they'll come out sort of close to each other. One of them is about, it's really a science book, but it's not written by scientists. It's written by sort of amateur scientists, if you like, so it'll be totally readable. And it's called The Nature of Existence, and it's how the universe actually works on this whole spiraling process and what that means. And it's designed to be a book that any student in the world can read and start to think differently about how physical things are built and how processes happen. you know, what is a whirlpool and why is a whirlpool and where are whirlpools? And so a little bit of it is in the Shark's Paintbrush, but this is a book that hopefully can really reset the foundation for how people think of movement. You know, in our universe, for something to exist, it must be moving. So everything we look at, even if we think it's still, like the floor underneath us, we think is stable and still. But this planet is rotating through space at enormous speeds in a spiral. So nothing by its nature is still. Everything's made of energy, and that energy is always moving. What is extraordinary to contemplate is all of that movement. Every aspect of that movement is spiraling. And we can understand what those spiraling shapes are and the geometry behind them and how they can be exploited and what they mean, etc. So that's the first, that's the second book. And then the third book really looks at human understanding of the spiraling shapes and the nature of how nature moves. And if we go back to the beginning of humans thinking a thought, the very earliest icons for the mystery of life were spirals. And it's the most common icon through all religious traditions throughout the world. So it's either dragons or snakes or spirals. We'll find it everywhere, from Kundalini to Hermes staff to you name it. Even the yin-yang symbol, two spirals intertwined. And this is the most important symbol for the mystery of life, for the creation, for intelligence, for fertility and birth, and ultimately for the creator, depending on which culture you come from. So it's through all the shamanic traditions. So humans, as you can imagine, were walking through a wilderness. There was nothing but wilderness not very long ago, 10,000 years ago. And so it was all chaos, except now and again they'd notice these swirling shapes, either a whirlpool in the stream or a hurricane or the curls in your hair or an octopus tentacle or a seashell. And so this was order in the chaos and very beautiful in many cases. So early people saw it as terribly important as an explanation for the mystery. And so the third book looks at that and what is the wisdom that's come out of that through all time. And all of the great scientists and the artists of history as well have been fascinated by this. So it maps out that historic exploration and relevance and brings us to, okay, what does that mean to us today in, if you like, a spiritual context or in a what's the meaning of life context? So the three are a trilogy, if you like.
Beautiful, beautiful, yes. I think we're going to have you back on the show to talk about these other books, in particular the last one you mentioned that provides the spiritual context, because Gaia Field Radio is very grounded in the spiritual, natural, and interconnections between those worlds. They're not even separate. I don't even, you know, the language, they're not separate worlds.
Well, it's what excites me and what fascinates me is, to me, everything in life is a spiritual exercise. You know, the context of life is we come from somewhere, we don't know where we came from, we don't know why we're here, we don't know where we're going. I mean, we have all sorts of beliefs and myths and so forth, lots of them, but there's no common one. There's no truth that's absolute that we all know without a shadow of a doubt. So the entire context of our life and existence is a mystery. And that mystery is fascinating. And there are things that can be known about that mystery, and there are things that can't be known. But the things that mm-hmm. can be known can be extremely interesting and exciting.
Indeed, and you've captured a lot of that in your books and with your companies. I'd like to encourage readers to visit your various websites, which are on the page that you were on to get to this show, thesharkspaintbrush.com, natureofhope.org, and paxscientific.com. So visit those websites, check out Jay's book. We've got just a few minutes left. Do you have any parting thoughts that you'd like to leave with our listeners? And Francesca, this question goes for you too.
Francesca, would you like to start a conversation?
Well, a couple of things come to mind. First, thank you, Lisa, for the opportunity to talk about this because, as I said, it is such an amazing resource and such a great way of looking at the world. And so the more we can talk about it and the more that the people listening today can turn to someone else and say, hey, I heard this neat show. It's about biomimicry. Check it out. That is fantastic. We just need to throw a rock in the pond and get the ripples out there. The thing that came to mind, Jay, actually was just, you know, I really like that story that you tell sometimes. And I think, you know, just in the couple of minutes that are remaining, that story about when you were sailing and you came, you know, you had that experience of spotting that island. I wonder if you could just tell that in a couple of minutes.
Right. So some years ago, I was sailing around the world and I was going across the Indian Ocean and about a bit more than 400 miles from the nearest land. And the water was 12,000 feet deep, and sailing along. And in the distance, I saw something on the horizon. And I was outside the shipping lane, so I grabbed the binoculars, and it looked like trees. It looked like coconut trees. And so I thought, well, there should be no land here whatsoever, 12,000 feet of water. So it was in the direction I was sailing, sailed right up to this island, and as I got closer, I saw there were birds flying around, and there were fish starting to show up. And I sailed right up to it, and it was several acres in size. And it was made entirely of rubbish. And there were sea containers just under the surface, and there were fishing nets and ropes and an old dinghy and logs that are washed down from rivers in monsoonal times and shoring timbers off ships and you name it, everything that humans waste and throw away. And I was appalled. Like, what an incredible mess we make in this pristine environment. And as I was looking at it, though, it really struck me that from nature's point of view, there is no such thing as waste. There's not a single thing wasted. And nature had collected all this stuff together, and it had made a whole life support system for all sorts of species. There were crabs on this island. There were fish underneath it, schools and schools of fish. There were birds and seagulls. And there were several coconut palms. The tallest one was about 10 feet high. But there were seagrasses. So this whole life system, this argonaut, was traveling across the ocean, collectivized by nature. And it really struck me that it doesn't matter how bad a mess we've made, nature is a survivor. Life is a survivor. Life will be here much long after we're gone. All that matters is whether we get to go for the ride and we have a good ride. So nature will survive. We can learn from nature. We can learn all of these things. We can absolutely turn this world around. It's within our grasp. And we have modern technology, modern understanding, modern wisdoms, modern ways of exchanging information. We can do this, and we can do it quickly.
That is very inspiring. After all the bad news we get about climate change, to hear such inspirational words makes me want to go out and really do something. And I hope this program inspires other people to do the same thing. And I want to thank both you, Jay, and you, Francesca, for taking time out of your busy day to talk with us about these things. I think you're up to fantastic work, and we'll talk to you again soon when the new book comes out.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thanks for doing this work and supporting the efforts to make a better world. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for listening in. And join us next week again. We've got Steve Rosen coming to talk about his book, Dreams, Death, and Rebirth. All right. Thanks, and bye now.